If the conversation gets deep, talk about your boyfriend's old Jeep. And if they're not talking about you, mention how you just got the flu. Talk about the food that you ate. Tell them about the time you got drunk. Mention how guys always fall for you. Mention how you don't care. Ruin the conversation. Ruin the conversation.
That is my motto in life.
Hello, friends and family, and thank you for tuning in to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. You're listening to this on a very historic day. This is the day that President Barack Obama was inaugurated as the President of the United States of America, and I have actually sent a correspondent, the teacup pig, out to Washington, D.C. to report in and let us know what's going on out there on this very historic and beautiful inauguration day. So, how's it going out there, teacup pig?
Oh, Duncan, it is going so great. I could not be happier on this inauguration Monday. I'm here on my cell phone, and I cannot believe it, but Justin Bieber showed his bottom, and I just knew he would moon one day. I knew it. I would tweet that. I tweeted over 20 times. Today will be the day that Justin Bieber moons, and Justin Bieber mooned today on inauguration Monday. Don't you see what it means? Monday is moon day. Monday means moon, moon, lunar day. Oh, lunar moon god, thank you for sending your hypnotic beams down to earth and convincing that Justin Bieber to stop being selfish and finally show us what he's hiding behind his blue jean curtains. Oh, inauguration Monday, I will never forget this beautiful day. And I've been here under the bleachers of the bag of fresh airplane glue, just sniffing this glue and looking at Justin Bieber's beautiful bottom, Duncan, and I have to tell you that if I could, I would fly into his bottom and live there in that wonderful valley. I bet it smells like Dracar, and I bet he farts hip-hop. I just want to live in his bottom. I'm so overwhelmed by the emotions of this great, beautiful inauguration Monday, the day that Justin Bieber finally mooned, and I just will never be happier than this, so I'm gonna put this gun in my mouth and blow my brains out. Bye, Duncan.
We can rebuild them.
A pig who thought he could not go on.
I just want to die, Doc. Why do you got me hooked up to all these machines?
A government who wanted him alive.
We will transform you into the greatest weapon that ever lived.
A pop star who thought he was untouchable.
Hey girl, I'm gonna moon forever.
A day the nation would never forget.
General, the pig flew away with Bieber.
Teacup Pig stars in the erotic action thriller that's making critics cream.
Now it's just you.
Pink Moon, coming soon. Available exclusively on DVD at Blockbuster's 4 remaining locations.
Hi, everybody. That was put together by me, and that was at Brendan Walsh on Twitter and at Johnny Pemberton on Twitter, doing the incredible voice acting in that amazing bit of comedic gold. Beautiful. Brilliant comedy at the level of Louis C.K., I'd say, as far as intellectual cutting-edge humor goes. I hope you guys are all doing really well. I am going to give you a cancer update.
Cancer update.
Duncan Trussell continues to get radiation treatments using one of the most high-tech radiation beams on planet Earth. He's also taking pills that Johnny Pemberton told him are the main ingredient for Scissura, the stuff the rappers drink. They tend to knock Duncan out at night, but they stop the nausea that comes from getting radiation blasted into his stomach. Also, he had his sperm tested, and his sperm is incredibly healthy. That's this week's cancer update. Look forward to next week with more updates.
Cancer updates.
As many of you know, in India, currently happening is the biggest festival that happens on the planet, called the Kumbh Mela, or I'm sure they're mispronouncing it and I'm saying it right. I think the way that they're supposed to say it is Kumbh Mela. But it's this giant festival where all from all over the planet, saints and gurus and bandits and gypsies and freaks all gather together and meditate by the Ganges River. And so because this is happening, I thought I would read a really cool passage from Paths to God, Living the Bhagavad Gita by Ram Dass. And I'll have a link to the book if you want to order it on my website at duncantrussell.com. This is really cool and I love this story, and so I'm just going to read it. Whenever I think I'm making a decision about something, I remember an incident that happened with Maharaji. I had gone back to India for the second time in 1971. Pause. For those of you who don't know, Maharaji was Ram Dass's guru. I'd gone back to India for the second time in 1971 and had gone looking for Maharaji, but he was nowhere to be found. No one knew where he was. So I decided to join up with some other Westerners at a meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya. That's where the Buddha got enlightened, and I figured if it worked for him, maybe it'd work for me. But after a couple of weeks of meditating, I was ready to resume my search for Maharaji. One of the women in our group had come to India overland in a big Mercedes bus complete with a driver. She offered us the bus to take us from Bodh Gaya to Delhi, where we could celebrate Shiva Ratri and then go looking for Maharaji from there. So 35 of us, 34 meditators and the bus driver, all set out for Delhi. After weeks in a meditation retreat, we were all looking forward to hotels with real beds and hot water and to restaurant meals and ice cream cones. The road to Delhi took us near the city of Allahabad, which is where once every 12 years a huge celebration is held called the Kumbh Mela. Millions of people come here at an astrologically ideal moment to bathe in the confluence of the three sacred rivers. It is the largest spiritual gathering held anywhere in the world. The Mela had taken place just a few weeks before our bus trip, and one of the people on the bus who had been at the Mela insisted that we should make a detour to visit the Mela grounds. On the one hand, it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. After all of us were supposed to be practicing yogis, and here was one of the most sacred sites in all of India. But it meant an extra hour or two before we'd get to Delhi, and everybody was tired and hungry and getting cranky. The discussion went back and forth, and finally everybody agreed that I, as the elder in the group, should make the decision. I wrestled with it. Should we turn off? Should we go straight on to Delhi? Finally, when we were almost at the cutoff to Allahabad, I decided. I told the driver, turn right. We drove to Allahabad and pulled into the almost empty Mela grounds, just a handful of people walking here and there. This fellow who had been to the Mela directed the bus driver over to a little Hanuman temple he remembered visiting. As we parked next to this temple, somebody who was looking out one of the bus windows yelled, "Hey, there's Maharaji!" And there he was, walking along through the Mela grounds, holding onto the arm of Dada, his Indian devotee. We all poured out of the bus, crying and pranaming and touching Maharaji's feet. Maharaji looked unconcerned with our whole thing. He just said, "Come, come, follow us." Then he and Dada climbed into a bicycle rickshaw that had been waiting for them, and they started off through the narrow little streets of Allahabad with our big bus lumbering along behind. When we arrived at Dada's house, his wife came rushing out to the bus to greet us. "Come in, come in," she said. "Dinner's almost ready. We've been cooking for you all day." Maharaji woke us up at 6 o'clock this morning and told us, "Hurry up and start cooking. There will be 35 people here for dinner tonight." Now, who do you suppose it was who thought he was sitting on the bus deciding whether to visit the Mela grounds? Long before I made my decision, it was already decided. Maharaji knew all about it that morning. I played my part. I decided to go to the Mela grounds, but my decision was inevitable. So, that's a cool passage from Paths to God, Living the Bhagavad Gita by Ram Dass. Highly recommend that book. If you're trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita, or if you just want a cool spiritual read. Now let's do some business. We have a returning sponsor to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, the creators of my favorite bags on earth, DSGear.com. They create Dot Sasura brand hemp bags. These are the most amazing, coolest bags on earth. I'm not saying that just because they're sponsoring the podcast. I'm saying it because it's the backpack I use when I'm going on the road. It carries my laptop, variety of books, my chanting beads, my giant amount of condoms I bring with me on the road, as well as the numerous surgical gloves I require for so much of what happens out there on the wonderful, beautiful road. These bags are my antimicrobial. That means that here's what it means. It means that when you go to the gym with your Pikachu backpack and you accidentally put it down in a puddle of stranger sweat, and then you wonder why your girlfriend's covered with festering sores that from time to time regurgitate foul stinging larvae that sting your balls, well, the answer is your backpack doesn't protect against whatever was in that stranger's voodoo demon sweat. Dot Sasura bags, being made out of hemp, they are for viruses and bacteria. It's the equivalent of the Sahara Desert. There's nothing a bacteria hates more than landing on one of these bags. It's death for a bacteria. In the same way that eventually that Pikachu backpack that you've been hauling your Crayola crayons to Magic the Gathering events will one day cause your heart to explode and cause you to geyser out all of your lifeblood into the face of your children, which will scar them permanently and probably lead them to rise up and become dictators that destroy some religious group on planet Earth. So don't create that chain reaction and stop wearing these vinyl backpacks that are a chemical slurry made of Chinese electronic sweatshop workers and plutonium droplets. Dot Sasura bags are environmentally friendly because they're made out of good old-fashioned hemp. Also, they're the color of the night sky, as though the stars had been plucked out of it by grim reapers. So they look incredible, and they're great for hauling your throwing stars to the 90th floor of Saudi Arabian office complexes where you've been sent to assassinate bandit sheiks. Dot Sasura, it means escaping from corporate life, following your true will, and make your first act of following your true will getting rid of that disgusting Pikachu backpack and getting a man's backpack. Not even a man's backpack, a Grim Reaper's backpack. Go to dsgear.com, enter Family Hour in, you get 10% off. At least go check them out. They're awesome. Oh, man. This t-shirt is killing me. I think I'm going to cut my cock off. Just watch myself bleed to death. That's what I used to say every day when I woke up, wearing the uncomfortable t-shirts that I had worn for my entire life. But then I was contacted by the amazing t-shirt tailors at SureDesignT-shirts.com. They sent me some of the softest shirts that I'd ever worn in my life. These shirts were so soft that the first time I put one on, I had a 19-hour orgasm, and I woke up covered in my own jizz, delicious, warm, and soft. I knew from that point on that I would always wear Shore Design t-shirts, not just because I enjoy the safe, cocoony feeling of being encased in my own jizz, or because I like 17-hour orgasms, but because I like soft things. Soft things are the reason I wake up every day and the reason I go to bed at night. I wake up because a soft thing around my neck is being yanked by my dominatrix, and I go to sleep because the soft thing is cutting off the blood flow to my brain. And that soft thing is made of Shore Design t-shirts. So go to SureDesignT-shirts.com and check out their incredible selection of shirts. Beautiful designs that look like the blood splatter that might emerge from Jerry Garcia's head had he shot himself. Ganeshes, Hindu gods, everything you need to be the star of your yoga studio is there. SureDesignT-shirts.com. If you put in Duncan, you'll get 10% off. If you need a shirt to go with your bag, these are the shirts for you. SureDesignT-shirts.com. I love them. And I love you. I actually do love you guys. And I want to thank all of you who have been sending donations. It seems like after I mentioned paying off my stupid medical bills, a lot of you guys really got the message and have been sending donations or buying stuff from the shop. And I cannot thank you enough for that. It's an amazing, this podcast stuff is an amazing new emerging medium, and it really is flying in the face of the popular notions of the way entertainment works or entertainment gets funded, because you're directly funding this. So if you like the Doug and Trussell Family Hour and you want to support podcasting in general, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can go to DuncanTrussell.com and you can buy something from the shop. We've got a lot of really cool t-shirts that are made of the same fabric Shore Design t-shirts made out of. You can go to Amazon, you can go through our Amazon portal, which is located on the website. And if you're buying something from Amazon, just go through the portal. It doesn't cost you anything extra, and they send us a percentage of whatever you buy. If you really want to go crazy, you can donate to us through PayPal. And why not? Every other thing people pay for as far as entertainment goes, Netflix you pay for, Amazon, you know, when you download music you pay for it, when you buy coffee you pay for it. If you think this thing brings you the same amount of happiness as that stuff, why not just donate $2? If everybody did that, not only would I have enough money to pay for my retarded medical bills, but I would also be able to get a prosthetic testicle, which I'm never going to get anyway, but I'd be able to buy a lot of fancy high heels and purses to go along with my drop in testosterone. So go to DuncanTrussell.com. You can support us that way. And finally, you can support us by going to signing up for a trial membership at audible.com. If you go to audibletrial.com/family hour and sign up for a trial membership, they send us $15. All of this stuff helps, and all of it combines together to help support this podcast. Also, if you don't feel like sending any green energy our way, you can go to DuncanTrussell.com and just sign up for the forum and contribute to the awesome conversations that are happening there. They have a book club, they have a Minecraft server, and they have an actual video chat. Tiny chat is what it's called, where they all hang out together in a forum and talk. So go there, participate, become, let this podcast absorb and envelop you by joining the forum. And thank you all for continuing to listen. Today's guests on the Doug and Trussell Family Hour are Daniela Bolelli and Connor Habib. Daniela Bolelli is a philosopher and martial artist. He's written an incredible book on martial arts called On the Warrior's Path. He's also written a book about religion called 50 Things You're Not Supposed to Know Religion. He's a teacher. He teaches at USC, and he's an all-around incredible guy who's had a huge influence on me, and his philosophy towards life I've found to be very useful in my current battle with the big C. Also joining the Duncan Trussell Family Hour is essayist, author, and porn star Connor Habib. Connor Habib is a famous porn star. If you don't believe me, go to his website, ConnorHabib.com, especially if you like gay porn, and you will find out that he's quite a talented actor. He's also a brilliant essayist. He regularly writes for Salon.com as well as a lot of other great publications. He's got a book coming out. He's an all-around super positive, awesome human being who is a student of the philosophy of Rudolf Steiner and who actually does Rudolf Steiner groups in San Francisco. Daniela Bolelli has a great podcast called The Drunken Taoist, and I will have a link to that on the section of my website that this podcast is in. And Connor Habib is, as I mentioned, a male porn star, and you can check out his work at ConnorHabib.com. I'll also have links to some of his writing on the website. So everyone, please welcome these two brilliant, incredible individualists to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Send them your love. Welcome Connor Habib and Daniela Bolelli.
It's the Duncan
Holy shit. Here we are with two of the favorite guests of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, Daniela Bolelli and Connor Habib. Welcome.
What's up?
I don't know. You tell me.
The magic triangle temple.
Yeah. This is a true nexus of different philosophies. I don't know what's going to happen from this. If anything gets us on a government list, this will be the podcast that does it, I'm sure. So how's it going, you guys? What's going on?
Connor, you go.
Mine is that year. I just got to LA, right? And I was just before I got out here. Should I go? Let's go there. Let's get real, folks.
Let's do it.
I found out that my friend, this guy I know, killed himself two nights ago, just before I got here, and I haven't seen him for a couple years. But I'm just like, I'm taking it in, you know. He's one of those people you'd say he always seemed happy, you know, he's always smiling, all that kind of stuff. So, and he was a porn director. He's actually the person who got me started making movies, basically, many years ago. And I'm just taking it in. I mean, I'm not like destroyed or anything, but I'm just thinking about what he must have been going through and what that's like and what he's, you know, maybe going through right now. Yeah.
Well, what you mean where he could be now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, man, because I don't know. To me, is one of the things. Suicide is one of those big taboos that people freak out about. It's like the worst thing ever. Is this cowardly thing? Is this and that? I don't know. I mean, it really depends on. I don't think anybody can say what the hell is going on through another person's mind and heart and soul that way. So it's like, how the fuck do you know what you would want in that situation? You know, you can be insanely healthy physically and maybe you're in just so much damn constant pain psychologically. It's not like I'm encouraging or saying, yay, suicide club, that's so much fun, let's do this. You know, that's not the point at all. You know, yes. Far from it. I enjoy life like crazy. You know, I wouldn't feel like I want to give it up for one fucking second because I like it so damn much, you know, so give me more, more and more. But at the same time, I don't know. I feel like people tend to be really damn quick to rush to judgment about what happened to this other person. They took the easy way out. I don't know, man. It's like you try being them for a while and then tell me how that plays out, you know.
I agree with what you're saying. And I think that there's some refreshing and nice. It's nice to know you can kill yourself. It's nice to know that there's a plug you can pull
on
the raft.
Right?
Right? You could, like, if you want to deflate yourself into nothingness, you can do that. And I think that's a good thing to know. But I do think that right now on the planet, there is a necessity for as many cool people to stick it out here as long as they can, even if they're suffering, just because, as you could see what's happening, there's all this turbulence that's being caused by a glut of dumbasses trying to hold back progress. So if you're, and I don't know, I'm assuming that this guy was super cool because he's friends with you. Yeah. If you're interesting and cool and smart and have something to say, or even have the inkling that you have something to say, I think it's your job to stay at the party more so than maybe at other times in human history.
Yeah, and I think in one sense, it is like you can look at it as, well, I'm pulling the plug, right? But I had a friend say to me once, a friend who's like a really super high up in the echelon occultist guy in this order called Servants of Light, which is, so OTO is Crowley.
Yes.
Servants of the Light comes from Dion Fortune, who was doing stuff around the same time as Crowley, right? So he's in that. And he was like, well, I stopped wanting to kill myself when I realized that my pain wouldn't end after I died. So it was like,
right.
If you have any concept of an afterlife or whatever, he was saying, like, you know, it doesn't stop. Like, you kill yourself and the pain follows you over to the other side.
This is kind of the momentum. It's like the notion of this, there's a spiritual momentum that people have, and that just because your physical body stops, the momentum or the trajectory that you're on doesn't stop at all. It just continues on in some other form.
Right, and you usually want to kill yourself because, I mean, one of the things that makes you want to kill yourself is confusing your body for your spirit. So, like, if you think that all you are is your body, then you think that it's ending it by killing yourself. But so it ends up being like this weird materialistic pressure. Ultimately, is what suicide is.
It's a materialistic pressure, and it's also it's kind of asking a big favor from a lot of your friends, because you know what I mean? Like you're telling people, well, now you guys have to do a funeral. You've got to get my coffin. And this is an inevitability, but it's like prematurely you're like, hey, I want all you guys to now spend the next couple months neurologically rewiring your brain to get used to the idea of a universe that I'm not in anymore. So it's a tremendous imposition to put on a lot of other people,
right,
who are going through the identical universe that you happen to be going through. The same kind of turbulence, the same kind of... Now, there are exceptions. Debilitating illness, for example, sure. when the machine starts breaking down. The people in the World Trade Center who had to decide between getting burnt to death or falling to their deaths. There are obviously plenty of great reasons to pull the plug. Great reasons. But just because you listen to Elliott Smith a few too many times this week does not mean you should shoot yourself or hang yourself.
You know, it's fun. I'll play it both ways. Because on one end, I don't know, maybe because I just, if you throw enough money, I'll argue for whatever position. So I'll just, I should train myself. And yeah, please give me 1 cent on each side. So I'll play both sides. On one end, to kind of defend it in a way, I feel that people are responsible for their own shit. So if somebody else feel that they are supposed to do the funeral, rewire thing, it's like, hey man, you know, everybody's responsible for their own stuff. Nobody's asking you what to do. I'm just doing things because it's my own damn life and I want to.
So well, you're not going to bury yourself, asshole.
So what about if like they implode or something? They just strap themselves to like 3,000 pounds off.
Yeah.
That would be...
Or throw yourself to like those African painted dogs or something so that there's no mess to clean
there
up.
There has to be like, a disposal system if you're going to do it.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, there needs to be a vacuum tube that shoots you into space.
You have to infect yourself with like necrotizing fasciitis that just eats all your flesh.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Why not?
Well, that's one side. But then the other side, no, I agree with you because the fact is the... to me, people are really scared of being hurt, of pain, and that affects everything. You know, affects their choices, affect their relate out to other human beings. They affect their how much they are gonna put themselves on the line and all of that stuff. And my thinking is like, really, because of pain, because you get hurt. Welcome to the world, man. You get hurt every day.
Yeah.
So fucking what? You know, that doesn't seem like... what's the big deal about that? You know, it's like being alive. And in that sense, that's exactly what you're saying. It's like being alive means inevitably there's a ton of getting hurt involved. Yeah. And you don't know what the hell it means afterwards. So why not fix it here and now? You know, why not deal with the ability to deal with pain and getting hurt and things not going your way here and now in this body, in this place? I can see how that would be not only a viable option, but one that definitely should be encouraged. And particularly, as you're saying, if you are a cool human being to begin with, where then in that sense there's already not that many, so please don't reduce the numbers.
Yes,
right.
And also that whatever the thing is that's emerged into your life that is making you want to pull the plug, this thing, if you can figure out how to beat it, if you can figure out how to conquer it or transform it, then you are going to teach so many other people how to deal with that exact same enemy when it comes into their lives.
Yeah, of course.
So there's also this responsibility. And there's this, one of the great verses in the Bhagavad Gita is, what a great person does, others will follow. So if you manage to turn whatever the dragon that's emerged into your life, if you manage to conquer that or subdue it, then you're helping so many other people. Think of Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl. He gets thrown into Auschwitz. He turns the entire experience into the basis for one of the most amazing systems of psychotherapy, logos therapy. And the end result is that God knows how many people in the world, their suffering is alleviated because he wasn't one of the many people who in that situation decided to hang themselves.
Right. By the way, quick... you mentioned the Gita. I just a random thought I'm having, but I'm thinking you should really work on translating some of it.
That's why it's on my mind, because I'm mid translation of the damn thing.
So I also just want to add that, like, I've actually never said this publicly, but basically until a year and a half ago, I had sort of crushing depression or anxiety my whole life, and not like 3 days would go by without me thinking about killing myself.
Right.
Like, really terrible. So a mental illness it is just as bad, if not worse in some cases, than having some sort of physical thing going on where you would pull the plug or whatever. But you're talking about the struggle to deal with that and how you overcome it and stuff. But interestingly, for me, mine just lifted. It just disappeared. Mm-hmm. I had a friend that died, and we had talked about maybe before, this scientist, Lynn Margulies. So we were really close. And when she died, it sort of flipped. And in my meditation, I would like sort of encounter like this weird presence of her, right? It was really bizarre. And then after that, all the depression that I felt my entire life just went away. So sometimes it's a struggle, but also like to give some sort of message of hope to people who are like struggling and not, sometimes it just goes away.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's spontaneous remission is, you know, what they call it in cancer terms. So it's like, you know, you don't know what the universe has in store for you. Sometimes it's not about struggle. Sometimes it's about endure. And that's a different kind of way to deal with it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And there you are. So just from the fact that you did endure and didn't kill yourself, people listening to this who are depressed, at least they hear this idea. There's this glimmer of hope. So that's why it's I think it's good as much as you can just to hang in here. Because the thing is not going to last. Don't worry. You're dead no matter what. There's no way to escape. You're dead. You are fucking right. Dead. So fight. Whether it's a fight of endurance or whether it's a fight of direct confrontation, just fight.
No, I agree with you. I guess because I'm so used to hearing the kind of negative criticism on anybody that offers himself. And, you know, the bottom line is I agree. To me, is pain... For me, for my own individual life, is not a reason not to want to live. You know, getting hurt, depression, deep, horrendous. I mean, when I think about the worst times in my life ever, where I feel like nobody in the world has ever been hurt that much, which obviously is bullshit, right? Because everybody who's hurt feels that way at one point or another. But you feel like you can't possibly take it kind of feeling. And I still wouldn't trade not feeling that. You know what I mean? If there was a way for me not to feel that, but that comes at the expense of getting rid of the rest of my experience, no, I'd take it any day. You know what I mean? Well, okay, universe, not any day. So I'm not sending messages out there. But you know what I mean? It's like, so I do get it and I understand. And I guess the only part that the slight touch to that is that everybody, regardless of who they are, people tend to respond really badly to news of people killing themselves. Like, that was such a horrible thing. Yeah. You are a coward. You suck. It's like, back off, man. Somebody was in so much pain that they killed themselves. Is it my choice? Do I recommend it? No. By the way, because we need listeners, so you guys, please don't kill yourself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, our numbers will go down, and that would be bad. So, you know, far from it. I don't at all. But at the same time, I wouldn't be so quick to judgment, particularly because, again, it's somebody who was obviously going through a lot. Just back off, you know.
Yeah.
It's their thing.
Hey, it doesn't matter if you're judging them. They're dead. Don't forget that. It's not like you're going to hurt their feelings. They're gone.
Well, I want to say, too, like, it reminds me of that Houston, you must know Houston Smith, who he talks about the world and ideas about utopia, and he says the whole idea of utopia is misguided because the world is a training ground for the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So when I just sort of take that lesson of suicide and like depression and killing yourself and all that kind of stuff, it's not that you're not supposed to not suffer and your life is supposed to be happy. In fact, the suffering is a training ground, and then somehow pull that out into the bigger picture of the world. You know, like we have an expectation that the world will somehow ever be like that. And in fact, it's not that we should have peace or utopia. The idea is that we should always be working toward it, right? And that's a different sort of message.
That's great. You know, I was just thinking this idea of like how miserable the world would get if it was a utopia, and how that would become its own awful burden and challenge to overcome, because with no obstacle or no obstruction, it seems like the things that create unique individuals and personalities and differentiate people we'd all be this kind of homogenized sort of sense organ. We'd all just be like erect penises sticking out of the world.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah, but even eventually that's going to get old, man.
Yeah.
Nobody wants a planet full of cocks, just like all the exact same, all jizzing at the same time over and over again. It's boring. You need the resistance. You need the resistance. You know, and that I think that's something people spend their whole lives trying to escape from, right, from, you know, periods of suffering or conflict or confrontation. And whenever they arise, your pulse goes up and you think the world's malfunctioning, when in fact, just like you're saying, Connor, it's you've been given a new machine at the gym. Whenever the suffering comes, it's like, you know how cool it is at the gym when suddenly there's some weird new Stairmaster 90,000 or some kind of cool new machine? I don't know. I like that. Right. Even though I'll never use it, it's still cool. In the same way, when suffering emerges into your life, you've been given this new Stairmaster. It's like you can either let this thing crush you, mm-hmm, or try to ignore it, or you can use it to become more of an interesting person.
Yeah, in that sense, is the metaphor you're using kind of like exercising? It's like doing weights. You know, it hurts sometimes. You know, yes, what I mean? When you're working out, you do feel the burn. You feel tired. You feel like, fuck, I don't want to be here. Just bring me the chocolate cake already. You know, enough with this shit. Yeah. But at the same time, that's how you grow, both physically in a literal sense as development of muscles, as well as mentally does the same thing through obstacles. Now, at the same time, we shouldn't, you know, be in all glorifying suffering, like, oh, how cool. No. You got this really nasty shit happening to you. Look at the opportunity in this. Well, fuck you. You deal with it, you know. It's, yeah, like, but at the same time, because you deal with it anyway, you know, it's not that because you don't want suffering, it goes away. Then you might as well seeing it as an opportunity and make something cool out of it, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And on that, there's like... Nietzsche had this whole concept of eternal return, where basically the idea is, what if somebody strike a deal that you can relive every single aspect of your life? You know what I mean? You start again from zero. That means you relive all your best, most ecstatic moments and all the most horrible tragedy and pain. Do you say yes or no to that? You can't change a thing. You relive the whole thing exactly as. You don't get to change it. You don't get to play with it. Do you accept all the suffering you have gone through to enjoy the good stuff or not? Hmm. And to me, in fact, that's why to me suicide doesn't appeal to me the slightest, because to me is a definite yes, regardless of how much pain one can have gone through.
Yes.
You know what I mean? At the same time, and I guess the reason why I keep playing back and forth is because the opposition to suicide, a lot of the time, I hear it from people that they and the rest of the world would have been much better off if they offed themselves 30 years ago, you know, because they are whiny, annoying little bastards who are all like, the selfishness of suicide is so terrible. No, trust me, it's way more selfish listening to your shit all day long and you dumping it on the rest of the world. It's like, please kill yourself already, you know. It's like, so, but yeah, that's...
Yeah. Well, and maybe you could, I think you understand this stuff, Connor, because I don't, but maybe you can help me understand this more. In Gnosticism, there's this idea of the veil covering God, or there's, mm-hmm, this veil covering the eternal intelligence that all things are coming from, and that the phenomena of suffering is just one little part of this veil. But behind it, it's almost like you can peer through it to this beautiful thing that's on the other side. And the moment you do that, the pain gets transformed.
Yeah, it's so funny because I was thinking about that yesterday. I spilled hot tea on my hand. And
always fun.
It was fucking blast. So I spilled hot tea on my hand, and I yelped in pain, and then I was like, and I've done experiments like this before, so somehow my mind just kicked into this thing that was like, just what is that? Like, why am I yelping? And then I sort of stood back and I thought, oh wait, that doesn't hurt. It's just a different sensation, right? So I think that's part of, I mean, not that I had seen behind the veil, you know, and was standing with God, but I was behind some veil at that point and looking at my pain and being like, oh, it's just sensation. It's not something that I have to linger in and say, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. So there's something, I mean, so first of all, there's that difference between pain and suffering, right? So yeah, suffering is optional. Pain happens to everybody.
Right. Huh.
And then, but then also I was thinking about it in regards to when you and I talked yesterday, when we scheduled everything, and you were like, man, I've got this feeling that something's going to... So my mind started turning when you said, I've got this feeling that something crazy is going to happen with this podcast. And so I started thinking, like, you know, you have this book coming out called How to Create Your Own Religion.
Create Your Own Religion, yeah.
And I've been working on all this stuff, just presenting stuff, new stuff about sex, right? And now we're talking about pain. And what I've been thinking about is how we're constantly, all of us, all three of us, looking at like new ways to redeem old phenomena that have like fucked us up. So pain is the most, I mean, the most basic one.
Yes.
But that's something that like I would love for us to talk about more today, but also you bring it up when you talk about getting behind that veil. Like, what does religion look like? What does sex look like? What does pain look like? What is whatever way you want to go if you redeem it by sort of getting behind that veil, and how we all have our own sort of weird separate projects doing that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And everyone's got their own little projects to deal with it. My mind keeps thinking of this puppet show. Like, I keep thinking, like, if you're a kid and your parents are putting on this really spooky puppet show, if you just believe, if you, you know, get sucked into the stage and the puppets and the story, you know, then it could be quite terrifying. But the moment you realize that your parents are just behind it doing this thing for you, then suddenly it changes the whole thing into something that is fun.
Or even scarier.
Or even scarier. Why the fuck are you doing the cancer in the puppet show, asshole? Yeah, that's a good point. Like, why the fuck would someone do this ridiculous show? You know, I was thinking, another way I was thinking about it was like, just from using the tool of the idea of a god, or using specifically, just because I'm doing this translation of the Bhagavad Gita, I've been thinking about Krishna, the mischievous embodiment of like beauty, and like this, Krishna means like all attractive being, like the most attractive, the most incredible thing. So it's kind of like the input. Yeah, it's you, Daniela.
I know.
And I know you're Krishna.
Good. I'm glad you finally got that. I have to come out to your house every other moment for you to figure it out. Ah, we got there finally.
All right,
good.
All right.
You know when you're in love with somebody and you start staring into their eyes and you're like looking into their eyes and suddenly like you're looking very deeply into their eyes. You're not even just looking at their eyes anymore. You're just looking at like specific flecks of green in their eyes, like this one little pixel of like, oh my god, it looks like I'm seeing like the hot springs, I'm seeing like the primordial source that all things derive from, and that's just a human that you're in love with. So I was thinking, if you somehow did come in contact with Krishna or with the source of all creation, how much more would you get sucked into every single pixel of that being? And then I was thinking, well, I bet that if you did come in contact with that force or entity, you would get so sucked into the thing that you would begin to experience human life or the hallucination. Your very existence or your little bubble of your subjective universe would be one little pixel within the sense of getting sucked into the incredible aspect of whatever this being would be. And like, perhaps like death is the zoo, is the experience of like shaking it off and being like, Oh, it's just you.
Right.
I got pulled in again for like 1,000 lifetimes.
That's so cool. And I want to add to that too. When you are talking about looking into Danielle's beautiful, beautiful,
beautiful eyes,
beglassed eyes. Thank you. When you do that and you have that feeling, that actually is, you use the word extrusion all the time.
I know.
That is an extrusion of Krishna's body. So like, because gods and spirits and stuff like that, they're not material beings. Like, they're not gonna, I mean, they might every once in a while knock on the door, and that's really fucking scary. But like, usually we encounter them through an inner impulse, an inner gesture. And that's why some people like to say they're metaphors. I think that they're real beings. But so when you look into someone's eyes and feel that, then you're feeling that sort of extrusion of Krishna. So to experience like his wholeness rather than his extrusion, you would have to leave your material body. So maybe that is what happens when you die.
Yeah, it's just that blinking out like, oh, you tricked me again.
Yeah.
You tricked me again. I did a whole life in this moment of sitting in front of you. I did another life. And yeah, you know,
it's a wink.
It's a wink. And so then all of a sudden when you start thinking in that way where it's like, oh, these are just pixels of this omnipresent, super attractive, all-encompassing love being, then all of a sudden when you're, you know, I was thinking about this as I was driving in traffic to go get radiation, and someone clipped the side of my Mini Cooper just a little bit, just tapped the fucking side of it. Nothing happened, but I'm thinking like, yes, this is it. Oh, I see now. It's like I'm driving through Krishna's face. This is beautiful. And then someone clips the side of my car, and it's just right back to,
motherfucker,
you stupid fuck. What the fuck is wrong with you? Immediately angry again.
Right.
You know, the thought experiment doesn't hold up when the real shit happens. You know,
That's why they have this story of an encounter between this monk and the samurai talking about Zen. And I'm butchering the story because I read it so long ago and I probably read it in multiple versions. Maybe I dreamt it. Who the fuck knows? In any case, it sort of goes along the lines of the encounter between the two. And that was sort of the basic dialogue that emerges from there is that the peace of the monk is nice, is beautiful. There's something amazing about this sense of centeredness and compassion and that. But you're sitting on a fucking cushion on top of the mountain in a monastery. Try being in the middle of battle with stuff flying all around you, then develop the consciousness. That's more, not that that consciousness is bad to be, even in a monastery on top of the mountain, good for you. Not like it's easy to achieve.
Yes.
But that's step one. You know, right. Step two is having that in the middle of the guy running into you on the freeway or fucking swords coming to chop your neck off.
Right.
That's where it's real. You know what I mean? Or not that the other one is not real, but the other one is sort of the glimpse of it. The second level is sort of when it becomes part of you in your everyday life.
And it seems like this is bringing us back to that idea of turbulence or suffering being kind of instruments for the evolution of the self, and that the monastic life, the suffering that it creates is one of the suffering of being removed from the world, or the suffering of being in an extremely disciplined life. Whereas out here in the world, in the marketplace, it's a different type of suffering altogether, which is the incessant appearance of whatever the thing is that comes to you, whether it's cancer, your friend kills yourself, you end up not being able to move into your house, whatever the thing is, it's how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with it in a way that's not phony?
Because that to me is what's interesting. You know, people have this idea of spirituality that's always very, you know, clouds of incense and plim plim music and on top of the mountain. And, you know, I like incense, I like plim plim music and stuff. But still, the point is, there's an element of it that doesn't take into account spirituality, as in playing with your kids in the mud. That's spirituality, with real consciousness. And it's in a way is more honest and more real than purely an abstract form of spirituality. That's why I think we talk about it, I think it was the last time we were having a podcast when we talk about sort of the difference between sort of fake, new agey, pretend spirituality and the real deal that doesn't even bother trying to be spiritual, because its very existence is spiritual. Its very awareness and consciousness of life is spiritual, rather than this image of, I am spiritual, which means I'm going to let things go. I'm going to... It's like you're trying too hard. You know what I mean? It's like it's good, but you're still... It's too heavy in your head rather than being natural part of your being. It's something that you're carrying in your head.
Yeah, it's funny to see the tendency to which side of the equation you're going to feel more inclined to sort of diss, right? Like I hear you, Danielle, a lot, like talking about, well, you know, this sort of like new age, like everything is fine, right? And my thing is often, I mean, I'm totally with you on that, but my thing more often is dissing like science and materialism and stuff like that. So it's like, these are two, this is actually a Rudolf Steiner thing. He calls these two impulses, one is Lucifer and the other is Ahriman. And so the Ahriman is like that, like total materialism, and Lucifer is like sort of rising off the ground, like everything's fine, there's no earthly thing. So when you find the thing in between them, it's a tension between the two. That's what he calls the Christ impulse, or this sort of path. And so you feel, it feels instantly spiritual because you're feeling the tension between these two forces met and balanced properly.
Right, exactly. No, I completely agree with you, because to me, it really depends on who's around you. Because you're kind of sometimes reacting to who's around you.
And they're both equally annoying.
Because I completely agree. It's like, if you put me, to me, it's like, if you put me in an environment where I'm surrounded by New Agers, I'll be like, screw this crap. Give me, you know, some rough and tumble. Right. If you put me in an environment where they are all these rough guys, it's like, please give me the New Age folk back. You know, it's like, this is crap. It's not about one is good or bad. It's just each one of these things is a bit off balance. It's not bad. is just too much of one thing, and so you're trying to bring it back to a more, I guess, real approach rather than a stereotypical approach.
This brings to mind a story I heard about how when Ram Dass and Leary were doing acid in Harvard, their peers were saying to them, "What are you doing? You can't take the drug that you're supposed to be using on subjects to create data. The fact that you're taking it is making it so that you guys aren't objective anymore." Yeah. And Ram Dass, in this meeting in front of Harvard, I think it was in front of the psychology review board or whatever, Harvard said, "Okay, well then I'm data. I give up the idea of being a scientist. You guys get to be that. I'm your data. Study me. Start studying me. I don't want to take on the role of being the scientist." But this reminds me of a shift from what was Aramond?
Yeah.
So that's like a shift from being the materialist scientist to Lucifer, I guess, being like, "Fine, I'm going to be blasted on acid, and you guys get out your rulers."
Lucifer is more fun. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But yeah. And I definitely tend more towards Lucifer than anything else, because it is more fun. But you know what? You do get disoriented, and you do end up getting so unattached to the normal world that you will lose your bearings and your compass gets all fucked up. So I like this idea of there's something comforting in Neil deGrasse Tyson and Dawkins and all the hardcore materialists, because I'm a sort of person that will become superstitious if I'm not careful. If I see the same number too many places, you know, like if I start seeing sevens or 13s places, I'll be like, "What the fuck's happening? Why am I seeing these numbers everywhere?" And there's something nice about having like a Dawkins in my head who's like, "What are you talking about? That means nothing. That's meaningless."
But that's so interesting to me, because the thing about Dawkins or someone who's like super new age, like on the other side, is usually what happens is this weird conjunction between the Aramonic side and the Luciferic side, and they just don't realize they're doing it. So there's no navigating the tension. So like Dawkins has this whole, you know, I don't want to get into it too much, but his whole thing about selfish genes, right? Dawkins has very little laboratory experience. He doesn't really work in the laboratory very much. Like, he was mostly sort of a philosopher and a zoologist. So he came up with this theory, right, that sounds really good metaphorically, but then when you start looking at the evidence, I know I'm going to get shit for this after I say this, but in fairness, I studied science in grad school for 3 years. Evolution specifically. So when you start looking at the evidence, like, there are a lot of better theories of evolution that like are much, much more based in actual observation of nature than his weird metaphorical thing. So in fact, he's positing this super ultra scientific thing and totally pretending to sweep God off this table. And yet there's this weird new age detached unreal element to it that he just can't see himself. So these two horrible sides join together, and that's usually what happens in fundamentalists. It's like,
that's great, where you get the worst of both sides.
Exactly.
Good job. Right.
It's like, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Wow. It's like all the rudeness of New York and all the conservatism of the South, but
lovely,
none of like the good features of either.
That works great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's crazy, man.
And that's why, to me, the whole thing, I mean, life itself, in a way, if I don't want to be too, you know, the metaphor for life or some shit, because in 3 minutes I'll change metaphor and it will be a different one. But in a way, it's like, I like the idea of surfing, because it's about keeping that balance that's constantly changing. It's not a fixed thing. It's not something that static. Is this balance that you constantly have to adjust. And what you do is you are slightly off balance one way and slightly off balance the other. And you keep going back and forth to adapt to your own body, the board, the ocean, the wind, everything. And if you go too much one way, you are a scientific asshole who has no appreciation for the deeper aspect of life. If you go too much the other, you are this new agey, positive thinking is the way. It's like, every one thing you do is not bad in itself, is how deep you go into it, how far you go without the necessary counterbalance, that's what screws you up. It's not that any of those things are wrong, is how far you go. And even that's too simple, because even that, like, you know, the typical answer that, you know, Confucianism, some forms of Buddhism have this, you know, the middle path. You don't go too far one way or too far another. Yeah. Even that to me is fucked up, because sometimes you do need to go too far to experience
it.
And just enough so that you can pull yourself out. But if you never experience too much, so to speak, you're also missing out on something. So it's this idea that in a way you're constantly adjusting nonstop, and that's what allows you not to get trapped in any one role, in any one philosophy, in any one single way of looking at the world, which ultimately is missing out on a lot.
This there's this concept that I've been reading about called the gunas. Do you know about this? So it's called the modes of material nature. It might be pronounced goons, but it's G-U-N-A-S, gunas. So this is, I believe it's a type of philosophy in Hinduism called Sankhya philosophy, where there's these three modes, the modes of the material universe, the mode of ignorance, the mode of goodness, and the mode of passion. And so the idea is that these three modes are, every single person has different varying, like, is it different? Some people are more inclined towards, to put it in a really base way, some people are more inclined to like spicy food, whereas some people like vegan food, or some people want to live a life of service to other people or doing charity work, while some people want to be like Wall Street power brokers, whereas some people just want to sit in their filthy apartment surrounded by cheeseburgers playing Xbox. And so depending on your karma, there's a these three, you're more inclined to one of these three modes, and in your life these things can shift. But there's almost a spirit of that you don't really have any control, that these three things are compared to like marionettes that are controlling you and giving you the illusion of self-determination, when in fact you're just completely controlled by these different modes. So when you talk about these another trinity, which is the materialism versus the sort of airy spiritual side versus the grounded middle point, it makes me think of the same thing. And when you talk about the surfing analogy, it also makes me think of the same thing, which is when you're surfing, you're constantly engaged in this relationship with the wave, energy wave that you're on, as well as your own balance and gravity. And so you're, these shifting elemental forces are going through you, determining how you can stay up on the wave. But what I want to talk about is this notion that that is still, these three modes are just still things that are temporary, impermanent aspects of being in the material universe. But there is another transcendent mode, which is what people call the state of mindfulness, or this, the, you know what I'm talking about? The Atman state, the state of being, of being the observer watching these three things happen, the thing that isn't touched by the material universe.
Right. So, and I like that. And I also want to say that there's something really dangerous about that too. So it's like, we always have to be on guard about all of them, right? Because we talk about, like, people talk about mindfulness all the time, and that's sort of our way of encountering that Atman state here, right? But what could be more frightening than someone who was always in the present and had no conscience, but was just allowed to do what they want, right? So a sociopathic Buddhist would be the worst like thing in the fucking world. Right? And you can take a weird detour in Buddhism and become a sociopath. Like a lot of, what is it, Advaita Vedanta? Is that the right? Who are just very like, everything is as it is. I cut your head off and I'm drinking, you know, the blood of your children right now.
I've never heard of that.
That's just fine. So it's like, well, it's, the world is as it is, and it's like there's nothing wrong with it. Everything's perfect, which in one sense is true, but in it's not inherently good just because that's true in one sense. So it's like the Atman is, has all its own like pitfalls. It has all its own dangers, but our duty is to sort of graduate into that danger so we can mess with that instead of the same boring shit like, oh, someone nipped my car, I'm pissed off, or like someone insulted me and I feel like shit. It's like, let's get beyond that and get into the dangers of the Atman, you know?
Yes.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's like, it's kind of like another way to look at it is if there was a paint, like when it's this very strange, but like when you look at a painting, when you're not looking at the painting, the painting doesn't exist for you. You're not seeing the painting. When you look at the painting, suddenly the painting becomes real. Whatever the painting is, suddenly the painting is alive for you during that time. So the idea is that we are the painting being gazed upon by the supreme truth, but we have become confused and we're the supreme truth gazing upon a painting. And because we're such a, what we are is so profoundly powerful, mm-hmm. that the thing that we're gazing upon, we think that we're that thing. And so this Atman is the idea of suddenly realizing, oh, wait, no, I'm not this painting at all. I'm something a million trillion times bigger than that. So I do know what you mean in the sense that if you were to trick yourself into thinking that you'd attain that state, you would almost take on this kind of detached, bullshit, sociopathic thing where nothing seemed that important because everything was just some temporary, transient nonsense. I do understand that. But the other idea is like, what if you really are this thing? What if you really are, forgive me for using the G word, but what if we really are God having this experience of just being lost in our own creation?
Right, but then there are gods that aren't so great, like the Moon God that you always yes. talk about. You might still become like a world destroyer, like suffering created an asshole, like once you get to that state. Like, I know what you mean, because you're talking about even beyond Jehovah, like even beyond all these like other, this whole like pantheon in the hierarchies, there's this thing that's essential. I totally agree with you, but we have all those things to pass
yes.
through in some sense too. So it's like, yeah, you can trick yourself, but it's not just tricking yourself. It's part of the pitfalls of getting there in the first place. It's like we have to pass through that. I don't know. That's my first reaction, but I don't know if I even totally agree with that. That's just what I was thinking.
It's just, again, because I'm getting sucked into the Bhagavad Gita. The verse is, you know, this is the second chapter where Krishna is telling Arjuna to fight, and the beginning, their dialogue of the why it's better to fight. And, you know, you know, he's talking about true identity, you know, what you really are. And he says, you were never born, you've never died, you never came into being, and you will never cease to be. What you are cannot be mm-hmm. cut, cannot be burned, cannot be withered by the wind, unchanging,
right.
immortal, and primordial. That's what you are. And so I, you know, reading that, for my whole life, having read that verse over and over again many different times, I've always just been like, oh, whatever, and you just keep reading. But then when you start thinking about that, well, what if that's true? What if that's actually true, that you are this eternal, primordial, never-changing field of consciousness? That in its own way is an insane concept, never-changing, never-born, never. What does that even mean? Is it even possible to use
right.
the human mind to understand it?
I mean, in that sense, it's almost like the concept of every single person that is in the world is really just you, taking it's you as this one divine being, taking a bunch of different shapes. So it's you, the one you hate the most, it's also you, the one, you know, because it's really, and in some weird intuitive level, there have been more than once where I do feel that way, where I feel like, I mean, I remember this one dream I had once where I was in that state just right before you wake up. So I'm becoming conscious and I'm aware that I'm dreaming and I'm about to wake up and I cannot remember who the hell I am. And I know that in 10 seconds, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to know who I am. And there's this sense of awareness, this sense of it's me. I have no idea if I'm gonna wake up being a black woman in Harlem. I have no idea if I'm gonna wake up and I'm a neo-Nazi. I have no idea if I'm gonna wake up if I'm a man or a woman. I have no idea. And there was this sense of I could really be any one of those things and I wouldn't be that surprised if I wake up in that body. And so that's on one end, you know, my more mystical ooh-ah moment. And then there was one thing that I was digging out while we were chatting because it got me thinking. This is the opening quote that I use for the book you mentioned, The Creator and Religion. There's a chapter about the existence of God and the afterlife and all of that. And just because I'm a punk, I decided to open with this one quote from Robert E. Howard, the writer of the Conan novels. So I'm just going to read it just
Please.
For fun. Awesome. This is Robert E. Howard writing. When was that? 1920s, 1930s, whatever. But he goes, I have known many gods. He who denies them is as blind and he who trusts them too deeply. I seek not beyond that. It may be the blackness averred by the Nemedian skeptics or Crom's realm of ice and cloud or the snowy plains and vaulted halls of the Nordimer's Valhalla. I know not, nor do I care. Let me live deep while I live. Let me know the rich juices of red meat and the stinging wine on my palate, the hot embrace of white arms, the mad exultation of battle, when the blue blades flame and crimson, and I am content. Let teachers and priests and philosophers brood over questions of reality and illusion. I know this. If life is illusion, then I am no less an illusion. And being thus, the illusion is real to me. I live, I burn with life, I love, I slay, and I am content.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah.
That's the end of the show, folks.
Yeah, that's great until you have a hangover.
Yeah.
And you're like, what the fuck did I drink all that fucking mead for?
Right.
Know? Or it's also like, it's such a great way to live, but then it's also like, until you get the hangover or the parking ticket or whatever you were talking about.
Or Parkinson's disease.
But then, or lupus.
Right.
Yeah, but then. That's funny. Anyway, or when you see an angel, or when you have that encounter where it's like, well, you thought you were going to just live your life, but now, like, some weird shit showed up. Now what the fuck are you going to do? So, like, so it's sort of like that is definitely the anthem for how to live the living human life, mm-hmm. and I love that about it. And then also, like, okay – so that's that part. And then what do you do when weird shit starts to happen, which it does to almost everybody I know. Some people just shuffle past it. Some people are like, I'm going to make a life out of this. Some people, they have just a total fucking breakdown when it happens.
Yeah.
You know, there's this band that I fucking love, Lungfish. Do you know them? They're like a DC Discord Records band. And they sing these mystical songs in this like really ugly voice, but the songs are just, the lyrics are so intensely beautiful and spiritual and bizarre. And the singer looks like Walt Whitman. He has this giant beard and tattoos all over his hand. And every time I saw them, I thought, he's just going to rise like 1 centimeter above the stage as he's singing. And if he does that, I'm going to have to change everything I've ever known ever in a centimeter, right? So like that... There's all that stuff about living in that intense, immersed way. And then also, like, but we can't be attached to the lawfulness of this world either. Mm-hmm. Like, there has to be some sort of abandon, because otherwise we are fucked when something like that happens. And it does happen, you know?
Well, yes, it does. It does happen. It happens to everyone in a different way, too, when it does happen. It seems like it reminds me of sort of the... concept of true will Crowley talks about, mm-hmm. the idea of, well, the goal is this in quote that you read, in India what would be called a kshatriya, mm-hmm. a warrior,
right?
And that's a warrior's philosophy.
Yep.
And if that's what you really are, if that's truly who you are, then that is the way to live.
And that kind of is who he, it's who Daniela is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to deviate past that is to go against your true will. And in fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm sorry to keep going back to it. I'm just obsessed with it right now.
You guys buy the damn thing before it's even out. Go for it. Yeah.
The beginning of the thing is a warrior, mm-hmm. who, instead of being a warrior, has become a philosopher momentarily. Yeah. And it's like, I don't want to fight. I don't want to fight these people. They don't seem like enemies to me. They seem like my family.
But even then, I would be, even though I totally agree that there is something as nature, you know, there's something in you that you're going to be drawn to certain things over other. Fact. That's how it goes, right? At the same time, I wouldn't be too quick to just embrace that and that alone, because then it becomes the stereotype of what that thing is. Like, to me, being a human is the fact that you can experience multiple things sometime at the same time.
Yeah.
So for me, the Conan the Barbarian approach needs to go hand in hand with the deep, nerdy, philosophical one, and needs to go with 10,000 other ones. You know what I mean? It's like that thing, like when Thoreau finished Walden, you know, when he says, nothing wrong with what I've done for the last year, I dig it. I don't regret a single second. But I have 10,000 more lives to live. You know, there's more than I want to be than just this one guy. And that to me is very... That's why to me, like, the whole surfing thing, or what you were saying about science and New Age and all of that, is all about being able to experience a whole bunch of them and hold them into you at the same time.
Yeah.
That's a personality that interests me more than the guy who's 24/7 Conan the Barbarian or 24/7 a nerd intellectual or 20. After a while, it's like, still? Really? We're still about the red meat and the crimson blades? And it's like, God damn, read a book sometime, you know, do something else. It's like, it gets boring, you know?
Yes. You know, man, this makes me think that we can commit suicide yet maintain our life. We can commit suicide in the same way that there's a relief knowing in the back of your mind, if things get really bad, you can commit suicide. There's also a relief when you realize, wait, I don't have to be this role anymore if I don't want to be this role anymore. Right. I can become anyone that I want to become. I can drop every single thing that I've ever done or everything I've worked for and start again, start a brand new life.
I love that.
Yeah. And I think that's so, I mean, it's such a great conversation for the people that are in the room right now too, because you guys are both, and I know myself, like this weird nexus of forces that don't often come together, right? And so I asked someone in the OTO about this a while ago, and he was like, well, Crowley would have said that when you can join those two things, this insane amount of power is released, right? Which made me feel really good about myself. And I was like, but where the fuck is the power? Yeah, exactly. I was like, really? Like, could the power pay the rent? But it didn't, you know what I mean? But I do think that, like we die and we're reborn many times in our lives. And that's so awesome. It's like a rehearsal for reincarnation, you know?
Yes.
And it's sort of like a sigil for it if we do all these things. But then,
what do you mean by sigil?
I mean, like, we're kind of casting a spell for our own reincarnation to go well if we, like, try on lots of different lives in our own lives.
Yeah.
And then also, I think, I don't know about you guys, but I know for me, the thing that I knew I was supposed to do, which was be in porn movies, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to do it or whatever, but I wanted to do it since I was so young. It's also the thing that's made life really, really difficult for me, and I struggle against it all the time. So when I think about how I want to set up some sort of anthroposophy or like Christian esotericism event, and I want to get people from that community involved, I'm like, but I'm a porn star. Like, I've done this thing that's sort of outside of that. And so I constantly have to fight against that impulse to stuff that thing that I am away. And I don't know about you, Danielle, but I've heard Duncan too saying like, oh, I'm just trying to find a way to like work all this stuff into my comedy. Like you've said that a bunch of times, but in fact, like this is like a huge part of it, dude, is you just having these conversations and bringing humor to them instead of like the other way around. It's like thinking you have to be a comedian in this certain kind of way where you stand up on stage and do jokes about this. But this is a way of being a comedian too, you know?
Right.
And so I'm wondering also for you, Danielle, like how you fight against that current and that course. And I think everybody probably does. Herman Hesse said something like, there's nothing more despicable to a man than becoming what he is. And I think that there's something like that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, because obviously there's pressure from every direction, from friends, from work, from in many directions to be one recognizable thing. From publishers, you know, they love to, you need to have a label, you know what I mean? In which part of the bookstores do we put you? You need to be somewhere. You need to be the guy that when we think about the one subject, you are it, you know what I mean? So there's clearly this pressure to put, have an image, a recognizable image that people are comfortable with, and it's non-threatening, it's simple, it's clear. And the fact is that goes in direct contradiction with everything that we're saying in terms of having this multiplicity of forces inside of you. You know, even when, I was having this conversation not too long ago because I posted on Facebook something where I was whining like crazy. I was just being this little whiny bitch complaining about, my this and the other thing and my book sales and I don't, it's like, and based on everything else that I am, it's just like, shut up, really? This crap? Come? And so I was called on it. Probably rightfully so in some way, in some terms of A, this is not you, B, and this is the part that pissed me off, B, there are people who look up to you and you can show this face. And I'm like, no, that's exactly the opposite. It's precisely because anybody can ever look up to anyone else, then you have a duty to be honest 100%.
Yes.
And if you feel that You are, that's what's coming out. You are whiny, and it's good to show that face and show that you can also go beyond it and be something else, and not just trapped into being whining forever. But if you deny the whiny part, or you deny the weakness, some other side, you're just trying to live up to this image that ultimately is bullshit, because you yourself don't live it 24/7. And so even though I completely agree that everywhere around us, people are trying to make us be one thing
because
it's simple and recognizable, you would be betraying yourself to do so. It's easier to get gigs of one kind or another. It's easier for work. It's easier for in a lot of ways, but it's not the totality of who you are.
An immediate thought experiment you can do to determine who is constricting you the most in your life is when you begin to contemplate some other mode of existence or some other way to live, immediately someone will pop into your head and you will hear their voice saying, "What are you talking about? You couldn't do that. That would never work. Gross. It's awful." Gross. That, you know, whatever the thing is, that person is someone that you have allowed to imprison you in their concept of how you are, instead of you being truly who you are, which is why the notion of the true will that Crowley talks about is so goddamn terrifying to really consider. Like, no, I'm regardless of the symphony of people who might protest my shift into some new way of being, I'm still going to do it because it's ultimately all that I have. If I start living the way another person thinks I should live, I'm a slave.
Yep, completely.
Right, but then there are these ways that we do it and we don't know that we're doing it, right? I was hanging out with my friend Chris Donahue. He hosts a show called Bad Sex. He does like all this sex therapy stuff and interacts with all these people, and they're like crazy relationships and stuff like that. And he was talking about how, well, we were both talking about how we just think monogamy is like really screwed up, right? So this is a way in which we concentrate all our being into this one kind of identity with one person. And he was saying, you know, a lot of times I have to say, well, you can't give this person what he wants sexually. You can't give this person what he wants sexually, or she. And so you are going to have sex with other people, or this isn't going to work. And he was like, they lose their shit. You know, they just totally lose it. And so I was thinking too about that. Like, there are lots of aspects in our lives. Like, we can talk about it sort of. I'm sure there are aspects in my life too. Monogamy is not a huge problem for me, but there are lots of aspects in our lives where, you know, we talk this sort of talk about being our true selves, but then there are certain pressures that we don't even see where we're like, oh, well, I got to go along with that, or it's going to piss the other person off. It's going to hurt the other person. I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be this. I'm going to be ostracized, whatever, whatever. So there are all these pockets. So finding those pockets in your life where you feel like you have an idea about how something is going to be, and then just checking in with yourself and being like, is this intention or compulsion? Which one is it?
Ah. Yeah. Interesting. It creates an incredible swooning, standing at the edge of a giant void feeling when you begin to start pulling away these mental constructs or thought prisons that you're trapped in. You know you're doing it when you start getting this combination of extreme excitement, like life all of a sudden wakes up again. The world stops being this dying old man hooked up to machines on a bed and suddenly turns back into what it was when you were a kid, this incredible adventure. And it's scary. It really is a scary thing. This is not a, and I think maybe that's the big battle. Maybe that's the maybe that's the fight between all the other, behind all the other fights. Because when the shit comes, when the horrible shit comes, when the turbulence comes, if you're in love, it doesn't fucking matter. It doesn't, it's no longer, the fangs aren't sharp anymore. And when I say in love, I mean when you've fallen back in love with life again, when you've accessed that.
In love,
And that's why, going back to the to the where we started, the whole idea of suicide, that's why ultimately that's not me, because to me, I'm too in love with life in that sense, with the adventure of it all, with the multiplicity of possibilities that are in front of us, including the shitty ones. I want to experience it all, you know what I mean? I feel like I crave it. I doesn't, you know, I don't necessarily see a superior intellectual justification for why it needs to be that way, but it's in me, you know what I mean? I feel it, I crave it, I can't taste enough life, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in that sense, that's why to me, the whole suicide thing. I'm like, really? But then, you know, why stop it? Are you kidding me? Why stop it here? You know, there's so much more to... And again, not in a la-la, it's all beautiful, everything's going to be okay kind of way, because I get it, you know, that there's plenty of stuff that's not going to be okay, and there's plenty of experiences that are awful and painful. But the very idea of being in love with life does not mean you're in love just when things go well, you know?
Yeah.
It's not just... Yay, $1 million dropped at my door. I'm in love with life. Yeah, fucking easy, you know? Being in love with life is a statement of inclusiveness of it all. The beauty of it, the horror of it, the whole deal.
Yeah.
You don't get to just cut and paste the parts you like and that's it, you know?
Have you guys seen the movie Amore yet?
It's no.
Like, so it's a Michael Haneke movie. I think I'm saying his last name right. He directed White Ribbon and Funny Games. I don't know if you've seen any of these movies.
Fuck yeah, I saw Funny Games. Yeah, Jesus.
Amazing, right? So this is just a movie about this old couple. I mean, they're in their like 70s or something. It's nominated for an Academy Award, which is completely bizarre. It could be a play because it's just these two old people the whole time. And the man's wife... I'm not spoiling it. This isn't the kind of movie that can be spoiled by reporting the events that happen because it's about the emotional weight. So if you don't want to see it, skip past.
Yes.
I mean, skip past what I'm saying right now. But it's about this old couple, and they've been together forever. And the woman, who is like this, you know, intense, like thoughtful person, one day she just has a stroke. And the rest of the movie is him taking care of her as she slowly deteriorates.
Wow.
Right? And it's fucking crazy. Man, the movie's almost 3 hours long.
Jesus.
And it's just pain after pain after pain after pain. And yet that love and that tenderness that sort of comes through between them is really beautiful. And then, and skip past this if you don't want to hear it, but, and then he just puts a pillow on her face eventually. Like, he's just like, done, you know, I can't do it anymore. And there's a lot of reasons why he might have done that. You have your own interpretation, but what you're saying is... makes me think, like, most people don't kill themselves out of intention. They do it because they're in this panic. It just grows and grows and grows and grows. The panic grows. And then that's why suicide is very often super violent. Like, people slit their wrists, or they jump off a bridge, or they need to do this decisive thing that they can't go back on. But if you could kill yourself as an act of intention, I don't even know what that would look like. I mean, some people may be like, I'm going to go, you know, into this other world. I want to experience death. I want to see what that's like, so I'm going to plan it. But most people don't do that. And there is something about that to euthanasia, to euthanizing somebody. Like, we had our lives together, now we're done.
Yeah.
So there could be instances of intentional death, but it's hard to think of that. Because what you're talking about is being intentional about life. If you're that intentional mm-hmm. about life, you wouldn't get into this compulsive state where you just had to off yourself.
Right.
Yeah. I think maybe the impulse to suicide in a weird way is a good impulse because you're wanting to reset your life. You're wanting to get out of the mm-hmm. every single mode that you've been in for your entire life and go into something brand new, whether you think that brand new is nothingness right. or an afterlife. So in that way, the motivation behind it is good. The thing to keep in mind is you might be able to do that without having to cease right. the functioning of your physical body.
Right.
Totally.
And that is the sacrifice that that they call the leap of faith. And that is the incredible, that is the siren song of all the mystics. And that is mm-hmm. the crazy koan of the Zen monks, and that's what all the people who've crossed over are like, come on, you just got to right. do it. You've got to give up everything to come here, everything, including the desire to come here. You've got to give up, but come here because it's great.
Right.
And how to do that? Well, I guess we'll have to talk about that the next time we all get together, because I sure as fuck don't know. You guys, this has been the best one. This is it. This is the one. I gotta put this in some kind of like a nuclear vault somewhere. I'm gonna go back and listen to this a bunch of times. Where can we find you, Mr. Bilelli?
Oh yeah. If I may steal 2 minutes more of your
Please.
Life, or I'm just gonna make
I'm gonna the kill myself before you're done.
You may. I'll try to make it interesting, so you may wanna just want to hang on to what happens next. This is my drunken Taoist appeal. You may have noticed that by now I'm showing up on Duncan's podcast every other minute. You know, every time he's going into the shower, I'm there waiting for him going, can we do a podcast? Can we do a podcast? You know, he wakes up. I'm like glued to his nose going, podcast time? Are we doing? So give this man his show back. And tune in, listen more to add to your podcast list the Drunken Taoist podcast. We've had actually, you know, things have been going pretty well. We've had a lot of people listening. I'm really excited, but the more the merrier. So please join in. And in case my words don't convince you, let me call my friend here 1 second.
Hey, my friends, I got to ask you a favor because. If you don't listen to the Drunken Taoist podcast, one day you may wake up in a bed soaked in blood with a horse's head next to you. Or Luca Brasi may come your way making you an offer you can refuse. So please be good people and listen to the Drunken Taoist podcast.
Whoa, who was that? That was so scary.
I can't believe he just came in here and said that and then left.
Yeah, just waved by, left us some cookies and stuff. Wow.
Drunken Taoist, where is it?
So drunkentaoist.com. If you, my Twitter, I always have updates on when the episodes are released. My Twitter is at the, my initial, as in Daniel, and then my last name, Bolelli, B-O-L-E-L-L-I. That's the way to go.
Beautiful. Mr. Habib.
Hello. So I'm not sure when this is airing soon.
Monday.
Okay, great. So I'm speaking at MoMA in New York on January 27th. So no, it's MoMA PS1, like their big dome. So come to that on the 27th. I just got a book contract with the same publisher as Daniela here. So
congrats.
That book won't be out for a while, but I wanted to pimp it out.
Yay.
I have a working title, but it's not going to be the real title because it kind of sucks, which is Everything You're Not Supposed to Know About Sex. We'll see. And then I guess, let's see, what else? My website, which is just connorabib.wordpress.com, is my blog. And that has an essay about objectification on it, which just came out in a book called Exploring the Edge Realms of Consciousness, which I like that essay. So, you know, check it out. And then finally, just at Connor Abib on Twitter. I would love to meet and talk with you all. And you can send me naked photos of yourself, which people actually like to do. And I really like receiving them. People protest that. Like, I heard two people the other day talking about chat roulette. They're like, it's just all dicks. Like, it's just dicks on chat roulette. Like, that's it. And why do guys send each other pictures of their dicks? And why do they do that? I love that, man. To me, that's a form of love. Because I like that part of your body. So do it. And if you're a woman, you don't have a dick, feel free to send them to me too. And I'll pass them along to these guys.
Yeah, that's right. Forward them to us. All right. You heard it. Send Connor a picture of your dick and go see him at MoMA. And check out... Check out the Drunken Taoist. Thanks for listening and thanks for being on the show, you guys.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, you guys. If you like this podcast, why not give us a nice rating on iTunes? Now check out this incredible track, Wounded Son 2, from the Holy Sons, and it's from their album, Enter the Uninhabitable. You must buy this album, anything by the Holy Sons. They're my favorite band. Bye.
No. I've done it so many times, but I haven't done this one
very many times.
That they'll never know. It's that I'm infinitely happy. It's impossible to pigeonhole a smarty pants dance to a rhythm that is undermined. Inexhaustibly refined is a wrench to your undercarriage, chewing on spit from the lips of her undercarriage. Hey, I used to be a wounded son, taught by masochism. On the run, but now I got a message for all mankind. Oh my God, is it lofty enough? suicide if it's lofty enough for all mankind. Because my feeling's that it's rather elite. Yes, a chance that a summon may only find home in the ears of those who aren't too. Comprehension's moving too quick to catch it to tick. A watch is born of holy opportunity. Intelligence is ubiquitous. Well, I know the glory of all that's a foresight, and I'm born of it just like a watch is born of me. And we are both inventions of a holy mind. You see, all through the ages of tides, I never had to say, I never had to say, I never had to. All through the ages of tides, I never had to say that I tried, I tried, I tried, I tried. Eulogizing undifferentiated. This is going out to all those eulogizing undifferentiated. Why don't you just keep it up, keep it up? Why don't you just keep it up, keep it up? Why don't you just keep
there is something, Terrence, that a lot of people probably are not comfortable with, and that is somebody who in his lifetime has ingested as much LSD, this new drug of yours, DMT, and God knows what else, probably a lot, is not supposed to sound as articulate and as literate and as well-preserved mentally as you do.
You've got a dreamer in the dream, and the problem is first touch and they tell me what to do. Always what they said just seemed to write, right to type, type, type to write, type to me. When you get to the top, oh, 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 oh.
Slide around with a fuzzy head on my neck, sounds like you're talking out of your